Welcome back. More open forum on Catholic Answers Live this hour. If you are a Catholic, you're welcome to call. If you're not a Catholic, you're welcome to call. If you're not sure, you're welcome to call. 888-318-7884. We're just answering questions. And I'll tell you what I usually say. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, Catholic belief, Catholic practices, you're welcome to call. But Jimmy Akin's our guest this hour. So we can expand that out. If you have a philosophical or moral issue, if you have a question about science or about Star Wars, you are welcome to call 888-318-7884 or really anything in this entire mysterious world. If you've got a question about it,
there are some very mysterious things in the world.
There are some very mysterious things in the world. And also, Jimmy Akin, in addition to being senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of The Bible is a Catholic Book, which is on sale right now. We'll talk a little bit about that later.
Okay.
He's also the podcaster behind Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, the popular podcast about virtually everything mysterious.
Yeah.
So what'll drop this week?
Tomorrow we have our episode on UFO close encounters of the kind in Brazil. So fatal UFO encounters in Brazil.
Are you just starting with the bees and you're going to go through every country in the world?
No.
Okay.
We have a different topic next week. Next week is the Magi. Who were the Magi? What were Magi? All that kind of stuff.
Yes. 888-318-7884, the number, 888-318-7884. Let's start with Diana in Portland, Oregon.
Let's.
Diana, your question for Jimmy.
Oh, yes, I do. So I have a question, and it's my son died 3 years ago.
Oh.
We raised him Christian. Mm-hmm. He actually took his own life, and we had him cremated.
Mm-hmm.
But then I came back to the Catholic Church, and I just wanted to know, is there some kind of, I don't know, is that prohibited in the Catholic Church, being cremated?
No. Cremation isn't prohibited as long as it's not being done for reasons contrary to the faith. Apparently, some centuries ago, there were some people who said, I'm going to get cremated as a sign of I don't believe in the resurrection or something.
Okay.
And so that would be contrary to the faith. But if you want to be cremated or you need to cremate a relative or something, as long as it's not for some reason like that, it's perfectly fine. And even the people who did get themselves cremated as a sign of rejection of Christian teaching are going to be surprised, because God came up with the atoms in your body in the first place. He can put them back together even if you deliberately tried to separate them.
He can find every atom.
Yeah. Or make new ones.
Does that help you, Diana?
Yes, it does. It makes me smile. Thank you.
Very good. Well, thank you for the call.
I want to encourage people to pray for your son and your family and everybody in similar situations.
Let us go now to, well, let me see here. John in Iowa, listening to EWTN on Sirius XM satellite radio channel 130. John, your question for Jimmy.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm on the road. I apologize if the call's coming in garbled.
That's okay. What's your question?
First of all, my question has to do with organ donation, as the previous caller somewhat related to that.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading an article from 2011 that said Pope Benedict XVI was a registered organ donor. However, that became invalidated because he became the Pope, and if he were to die, his organs would not be able to be donated. And one of the takes that I had read was that, well, if he becomes a saint, or if any pope becomes a saint, then those organs would be inside someone and they would be relics. And it didn't sit well with me, that take.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to get your guys' thoughts.
All right, John. Thank you. First of all, I want to say thank you, because this is a perfect Jimmy Akin question.
Mm-hmm.
This is we even do a whole show with Jimmy every 4 or 5 weeks called Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. And I'm not categorizing this as a weird question, but it's a pretty weird question.
Yeah.
So,
whether or not a pope chooses to donate his organs is entirely up to the pope. And it may be customary for popes not to donate their organs, because very often after they die, there is an investigation regarding whether they should be considered a saint or not. And actually, personally, I think it's a certainty Benedict XVI is going to be considered a saint one day. He's going to be canonized. I don't know if it'll be as quickly as, for example, John Paul II was canonized, but as the first pope in 600 years to walk away from the papacy for what he perceived to be the good of the church, that is heroic virtue. And it is certain that into my mind that he's going to be declared a saint one day. Now, having said that, even though they may want to keep the body intact for purposes of any pope, for purposes of seeing is he incorruptible or things like that, a pope has the ability to donate his organs if he wants. I mean, there's no canon law that prevents a pope from doing that. And the pope himself is the legislator of canon law. So he can always, even if he has a general rule for everybody else, he can make an exception for himself. So there's nothing stopping a pope from doing that. In terms of what would the status of such organs be after the fact, would they be considered relics? Well, a relic is, in this case, an object that was part of somebody else's body, and that person is in heaven. But there are loads of people in heaven, and therefore there are loads of relics out there in the world. And it's a question of, well, how do you treat the relic? And if a pope made a determination in life that he wanted his body parts to be treated in this way, that would prevail. Also, I'd have a question about whether they should really be considered relics in the usual sense, because relics are classically understood, at least this type of relic, as a body part of someone who's no longer living. So, for example, if you have a saint who's still alive, we don't consider their living body to be relics. And consequently, if you transplant an organ from one person to another, it's not dead. Let's say you transplant a liver.
Yeah,
you know, that's not
that
a
would
dead,
be bad if it was dead.
Yeah, it's not a dead liver. It's a living liver. Now, you can say, well, you now have this other person's life sustaining it. You know, their soul is now, this other person's soul is now sustaining that liver in life. But that would just be all the more reason to say, well, this isn't a relic in a traditional sense. Having said that, if I was a recipient of an organ from a pope, it would be pretty special to me. And it would be a little unusual.
Yeah.
If a pope determined he wanted to make that gift to other people, he would be perfectly entitled to do so.
John, thanks for getting us started. Appreciate that question. 888-318-7884 is the number. It is open forum. And Jimmy Akin is our guest. And Jimmy Akin's book, The Bible is a Catholic Book, is taking the Catholic world by storm.
Metaphorically, but it's not actually affecting the weather.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah.
I was getting nervous. Just find out why The Bible is a Catholic Book has been so popular and, I have to say, so helpful to so many people. It's available as an ebook, soft cover book, and in bulk packages at shop.catholic.com. So pretty much any way you want a book, we're trying to get it to you, because you can also get it as an audiobook at audible.com. So get it as an ebook, soft cover book, or bulk book at shop.catholic.com, or get your Audible copy at audible.com. And they got a wonderful reader to read it. I think you'll enjoy the reader. That was Jimmy Akin. Right back after this.
Often unbelievers have a hard time reconciling the doctrine of hell with an all-good God. In fact, I've talked to Catholics who struggle with this. So what can we say to help? Well, first, the punishment of hell is not a kind of vengeance inflicted by God from without, but follows from the nature of sin. All those in hell choose it, and God's respect of man's free will doesn't contradict his goodness. Furthermore, it belongs to God's goodness to make a distinction between loyal and disloyal subjects, and to give their just deserts. What kind of a God would he be if he gave the same reward, heaven, to those who refuse to love him as to those who love him? he wouldn't be a good God. For these reasons, the doctrine of hell is not incompatible with God's goodness. I'm Carlo Broussard with a ready reason for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Now there's a fast and easy way to get in touch with EWTN, the EWTN Everything Number. Call 1-800-447-EWTN to get the latest information on programming, special events, pilgrimages, and more. Our EWTN Family Viewer Services representatives are ready to help you with whatever your needs may be. The EWTN Everything Number, 1-800-447-EWTN. EWTN.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live Open Forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest, and Victor is next in Las Cruces, New Mexico, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app, which we are very grateful, Victor, that you downloaded onto your phone. Your question for Jimmy.
Yeah. Hey, guys, thank you so much for everything that you guys do. I'm a big fan of the show. You guys have definitely helped me in my with my walk towards Jesus Christ. So thank you guys so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so my question is this. I teach confirmation in my parish, and I had a student come to me after class, and he pointed out Jeremiah chapter 17, verse 5, and I'll just read it real quick. Thus says the Lord, cursed is the man who trusts in man and makes flesh his arm, whose heart turns away from the Lord. So basically, he was coming in from the standpoint of just kind of contradicting the Pope's authority and priest's authority. So I just kind of wanted some clarification on how we can interpret that for him.
Well, that's totally not what is being discussed in Jeremiah. Jeremiah is not talking about the papacy because the papacy hadn't yet been instituted. What Jeremiah is talking about is he's at the time of the Babylonian exile, and the sins of Judah have become really great before the Lord, and consequently, God is going to let them be conquered by the Babylonians. But there were people at the time, there were various false prophets and various politicians who said, no, we can solve this militarily. And so we won't really get conquered by the Babylonians. We can make alliances with other powers and they'll keep us safe and we'll defeat the Babylonians in battle. And so we don't have to worry. And those are the people that Jeremiah is talking about. Jeremiah is talking about trusting in human power rather than in God, and is specifically in this case for deliverance from military defeat. And this is what's being portrayed as foolish. If you think that, well, God's determined something, but we're going to be able to thwart his plan by human power, God's going to totally go Tower of Babel on you. It's not going to work. And that's the essential point that Jeremiah is making. Jeremiah is not saying never have trust in another human being. Jeremiah is not saying God can't use human beings as his instrument. If God chooses to use a human being as his instrument, God is perfectly capable of doing so. But one should not trust in a human being when pitting oneself against God's plans. That's Jeremiah's point. So is there a principle here that we could extract and apply in other situations? And would it be relevant to the papacy? Well, certainly the general principle that humans are not going to be able to defeat God's plan, so don't trust humans to defeat God, that's a principle that's going to apply all over the place. That applies all the time. But it's not relevant to the papacy. In those areas where we're supposed to trust the papacy, we're not supposed to trust everything a pope says. If pope says, you know, I like chocolate ice cream, you know, better than strawberry, that's not something where God is divinely guiding the Pope. And so we don't have to say, ooh, chocolate ice cream must be better than strawberry. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to matters of faith and morals, God does guide the Pope. And consequently, one can trust the Pope when he's being guided by God. In that case, the Pope is serving as God's instrument, not as someone who is trying to thwart God's plan. And you can see how this principle, one thing that might help your friend is say, well, wait a minute, you know, what? Let's apply this to the very first pope. Let's apply this to St. Peter. Wasn't he God's instrument? Couldn't he teach authoritatively? Now, your student may say, oh, but St. Peter made mistakes. Yeah, he did. And so that means don't trust every single thing St. Peter does, because St. Peter is a sinner like the rest of us. But does that mean that God never used St. Peter as an instrument, or that he never divinely inspired St. Peter, just like he inspired Jeremiah when Peter wrote two books of scripture, or that we never should listen to the instruction of an apostle because he's a human being and that would be trusting in man? Well, clearly, Jesus meant us to trust the apostles, including St. Peter, at least when they're being guided by God, you know, when they're carrying out the official functions of their office. And in the same way, he expects us to trust other people that he's using as his instruments, including the bishops as the successors of the apostles, and the Pope as the successor of St. Peter.
Victor, I hope that was helpful to you. Thank you very, very much for the call. It is open forum. 888-31-TRUTH is the number. Jimmy Aiken's our guest, and up next is Aaron in Jackson, Mississippi, or is it in Michigan? Aaron.
Jackson, Mississippi.
Okay. So go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to ask you about the nature of regenerative baptism. I was listening to a talk by James White. He's a famous Protestant apologist. Mm-hmm. And his argument was that regenerative baptism would be ridiculous because otherwise a priest could go into a crowd and spray people with a water hose and baptize an entire crowd. And so I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Well, it is understood that in order to receive the benefits of baptism, one needs to not be opposed to receiving them. If you, as an act of will, have determined, I don't want to be a Christian, I don't want to be baptized, and so forth, then you're not going to receive the benefits of baptism. And so a priest cannot simply take a fire hose and start spraying people at random and have those people automatically put into a state of grace. That's you know, baptism presupposes various things. The minimum it presupposes is you're not putting a barrier in the way by your will. And that's what allows infants to be baptized, because they're not capable of opposing this.
Yeah.
But if you're an adult and you've determined, you know, I'm just going to be a sinner, I have these sins I like, I don't want to be a Christian, I don't want to be baptized, then even if someone attempts baptism on you, it's not going to produce the intended result. You're not going to be put into a state of grace by that. And baptism for an adult presupposes repentance from sin, to turn the will away from the barriers that you've put in the way of God's grace. And so that would be at least, you know, one of the key points that I would make in response to that argument.
Okay, Aaron?
Yeah, I just had a quick question, if that's okay.
Sure, go ahead.
So, for example, like in the 1972 movie, The Godfather, there was a baptism scene on a movie set. So would that be would that have been a valid or invalid baptism?
I see.
It wouldn't have been a baptism at all. In order for something to be an invalid baptism, it has to be at least an attempt at baptism. And play acting is not an attempt, because everybody knows this is just a simulation. This is not real. So it's like actors who get married in the movies. They don't have an invalid marriage with each other. They're just not married. They were only play acting. And the same thing applies to baptisms that occur on stage or in movies or things. They're not baptisms at all, because nobody is intending for this to be a valid baptism. The requisite element of intention is not present.
Aaron, thank you very, very much. I don't know if you know about this story, but there's a famous Hollywood actress who claims that she's married to another actor because she says when they were play acting this, they really did intend to do it.
And this is on cinema?
Well, yeah, they were making a movie.
Okay, so that means it's 20th century or later.
Oh, yes, yes.
And that means that if either party were Catholic, they were bound by the church's law to have this marriage performed before a priest.
Oh, and so
and they didn't.
Okay. Well, he says, the actor says they are not married.
Yeah. But well, the actor would be right.
All right, Aaron, thank you very, very much. Teresa, in somewhere here in California, watching on YouTube Live, we're delighted to have you. Teresa, your question for Jimmy.
Hi. So I started to read and watch videos about Blessed Salt.
Okay.
So just today, actually just an hour ago, I went to my parish, the office, to get it blessed.
Mm-hmm.
And the receptionist was saying basically it's not necessary because the salt is already in holy water. However, I was going to use the salt from, you know, sprinkling around my house. I was going to eat it, and I was going to give it to my mom. She's elderly, and she can't go to church.
Mm-hmm.
So, basically, the priest was kind of, like, hesitating, but mm-hmm. then he finally got up, and he went to get his water. And the receptionist was basically saying that, well, sprinkling or stuff like that, basically witchcraft that's intended. And I was like, no, that's not what I read.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't get a bless. I felt uncomfortable. Mm. My question is it proper of me to ask the priest to bless salt? Should I?
Sure, sure. Salt has been blessed down through the centuries. I mean, in the early church, they were blessing salt. So absolutely, there's nothing wrong with blessing salt.
There is a long tradition, I don't mean this in any disrespectful way, in the Catholic Church of don't ask the parish secretary.
Yeah,
there's
true.
It's better just don't.
Yeah, and in fact, you know, just say, this is what I want to have happen. And,
yeah,
you know, right. Just please do this. Talk to the priest directly. There's nothing wrong with having blessed salt. You can sprinkle it around your house reverently.
Yeah.
You can consume it. You can put it in holy water, whatever. You know, there are various uses. It's been used different ways down through history. In terms of the witchcraft argument, that's actually going to depend.
Oh, okay.
Because if you recognize that there's nothing magical about the salt— and there's nothing magical about the blessing. This is essentially asking God. It's a form of enacted prayer. It's an enacted prayer to ask God to give his blessings in conjunction with this salt. Then it's just a prayer.
Okay.
And God answers prayers. But if you think, oh, there's something that's automatically going to happen just because this salt has been blessed,
mm-hmm.
like God's promised to give his grace the way he does in the sacraments, and it doesn't matter whether I'm reverent or open or anything like that, there's something that's automatically going to happen here, well, then that is magical thinking, and it becomes superstition at that point. This is something that's mentioned in the Catechism. If you look in the section on the Ten Commandments, and you look in the section on the First Commandment, and you look at the section on offenses against the First Commandment, and you look under superstition, it talks about how one form of superstition is thinking that a particular rite, like having blessed salt, will magically perform some function apart from the interior dispositions, like are you being reverent?
Mm-hmm.
Then that is superstition. Also, you may want to check out an episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World that's coming out the second Friday in January, where we talk about the distinctions between religion and superstition, and magic, and science, and psychic phenomena.
Very cool. Teresa, thanks very, very much for the call. Go ahead and get that salt blessed. 888-318-7884 is our number. That is the second time, and I'm keeping track, the word automagically has come up when you're here. And you coined that phrase, I believe.
Yes, I did.
It's a great
I use it when I'm teaching dances.
Oh, really?
I will say, you know, this is going to happen, this is going to happen, and then you're automatically going to be at this position.
All right, Eric in Syracuse, New York, listening on 88.7 FM. You are next. Your question, please, for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, Jimmy. Hi, Si.
Hi, Eric.
Actually a little honored to be talking to you guys because
the honor's all
I'm
ours.
Actually in RCIA.
Yay.
Oh, yay.
I'm in RCIA right now, and you guys are part of the reason for that.
Thank you for sharing that.
Answers over the earth.
That's very kind of you to share that. Thank you.
But being that I'm in RCIA, I got a question, and I need the advice of a former gamer.
Okay.
I have a game that I like to play online, The game itself is a strategy game, but it involves things like magic and dragons and mythical creatures and whatnot. So my question is, if I play it with the intent of playing as a strategy game, is that violating the First Commandment, the prohibition against divination and magic? Or so essentially, should I continue playing the game or do I need to stop it?
All right, Eric, first of all, I don't know where you got your information, but I'm not really a former gamer. So
I am. I'm a former game designer.
Oh, that's what he's referring to.
Yeah.
All right, I'll let Jimmy answer it. Okay, but I got to do it when we come back.
Okay, when we come back then.
Eric, hang on. We'll get right back to get you your answer. And if you have a question, you're welcome to call. We've got lines open right now, which is actually kind of rare during open forum on a Thursday, 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884.
Everybody's favorite Catholic outer space delivery pilots return for their greatest adventure yet in the brand new graphic novel Weapons of War. Fresh from saving the solar system in The Truth Is Out There and saving the timeline of salvation history in The Big Picture, Brendan and Irk land in a magnificent domed city on Mars for what is supposed to be a simple shuttle job. But soon they find themselves caught up in a sinister assault on faith and freedom. Will Mars be lost to the enemy? Brendan and Irk's only hope for the flight is in the power of God's sacramental gifts. A totally new kind of Catholic resource for apologetics and evangelization, The Truth Is Out There series combines the visual excitement and quirky humor of graphic novels with solid popular philosophy and theology. The result is a series in which everyone from teens to adults can find accessible answers to questions about God, the soul, true happiness, and much more. Order your copy of Weapons of War today by calling 844-239-4952, by visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
How can the Eucharist truly be Christ's body? Does belief in the real presence mean that Catholics are cannibals? Do the Bible and early Christians support Catholic teaching on the Eucharist? In 20 Answers, the Eucharist, you'll find smart, solid answers to these questions and many more, helping you deepen your own appreciation for this most precious sign of Christ's enduring presence in the world. 20 Answers, the Eucharist is part of the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers, offering hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world, all in a compact, easy-to-read package. Visit shop.catholic.com today and take a look at this exciting new series from Catholic Answers Press.
Tomorrow on More to Life.
This Friday the 13th will help you deal with all those situations you're dreading.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Eric in Syracuse, New York is on the line. Eric is preparing to enter the Catholic Church at Easter this year, going through the RCIA, and we're delighted to have him here. He's got a question about video gaming, especially games that have elements of magic in it.
Right. So a video game is something you play that has that you're doing for entertainment. Well, let's see what we can learn from some parallels. What are some other things you do for entertainment? You read a book, you watch a movie, you go to a play. Those are all things you do for entertainment. And all of those things can involve fantasy elements, including magic and mythical beasts like dragons and things like that. Now, let's suppose you go and watch Lord of the Rings. Okay?
Yeah.
You go, you watch Lord of the Rings, you see Gandalf, he's the main character in a scene, you're tracking Gandalf. In a sense, you're identifying with Gandalf.
Right.
You know, you're putting yourself in Gandalf's head. You're thinking, what should Gandalf do now? You're feeling emotions based on what's happening to him. You know, what would I feel if that was happening to me, if there's this huge Balrog in front of me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would totally.
I'm not scared of Balrogs.
I would totally slam down my staff and say, none shall pass.
Yes.
So, you know.
Good luck. I hope that works out for you.
What happens, regardless of the form of the story that you're consuming, whether it's in a novel or on screen or whatever it may be. An audio play would be another option. I was listening to an audio play on my way into the office. You are virtually experiencing what these characters are experiencing. And if they're using magic, you know, and you're identifying with this character, you're mentally kind of imagining what it would be like to do that. And in the same thing, if you're playing a game, you're creating a story through the game, and you're imagining using magic or interacting with dragons or whatever it may be. And you know what you're doing here? You're engaging in fiction and play. And fiction is imagining a scenario where the world is different than it is. You know, and it doesn't matter what genre it is. If you're watching a totally realistic drama, you know, with nothing fantasy in it at all, you know, just because you like totally realistic dramas for some reason.
Sorry.
Yeah, well, that's kind of my reaction most of the time. It's still not the way the world is. You're imagining, what if the world was different? What if this person was real?
Yeah.
Even though they're not. And what if they did these actions, even though they never did? And there's no limit. God is clearly okay with fiction because he built it into us. He built the instinct to play into human nature, and not just human nature, into all kinds of animals. They have it in their natures too. You watch puppies and kittens play fighting.
Yeah.
They're playing. They're right. imagining what it's like to be in a combat situation. And there's a good reason for that. One day they will be in combat for reals, mm-hmm. and they're going to need to know how to handle themselves. And that's why God built the play instinct into human beings as well. It enables us to imagine and get comfortable and experienced with what would it be like to be in all of these different situations, some of which we will encounter. Now, we may not literally face a dragon, but we will face extreme fear.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
You know,
right.
And we'll need to know how to handle that and how to keep our heads in that situation. So God built the instinct to play into us, and he gave us imaginations to imagine the world differently than it is. And there's no intrinsic limit there. So just watching a movie, reading a book, playing a game that involves magic or fantasy elements is not intrinsically immoral. Now, does that mean everything you could do with magic in a book or a movie or a game would be moral? Well, in the ancient world, there was what may delicately be called love magic. This was a big form of magic in the ancient world.
Family show.
I mean, we're not going to go into a lot of detail on that, but it's shocking some of the things they did with love magic back then.
Yeah.
And it was one of the big sellers in magic, that and curses and healing. And so, you know, should you be doing that in a video game? I would not recommend it, just like I wouldn't recommend reading a novel or watching a movie where the character you're supposed to identify with is doing that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But in principle, you're imagining a world where God set it up differently than he did this one. So, you know, it's like you could imagine a world where gravity works differently.
Yeah.
In the same way, you're imagining a world where God built magical principles into the world.
Right.
And you can imagine that, and it's just fine. So it only becomes a violation of the prohibitions on performing magic when you try to actualize it in this world and think, ooh, if I have my character do this in this game, it's going to have some magical effect in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then that's magical thinking and you shouldn't be doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're keeping your fantasy separate from your reality, it's okay in principle.
Eric, how does all that strike you?
Good. Actually, do you got time for a quick follow-up?
Sure.
Now, the game I play has a player versus player element. Is there any concern that I would have about possible scandal, or is that just so far removed that it really shouldn't be any concern?
Well, could you invite a friend to go see Lord of the Rings with you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, then you can say, hey, let's play this game together. And we may have, you know, we may both be playing wizards, and that's fine. But unless your friend has some kind of fantasy reality blurring thing going on in their head where they think somehow real magic is involved in this game, or if it's going to pose some other, you know, danger to them, like maybe they're tempted to be a neo-pagan.
Oh, yeah.
You know, well, then you probably don't want to invite your neo-pagan friend to play this game with you, but then you probably wouldn't want to invite your neo-pagan friend to go see Lord of the Rings with you. But unless there's special circumstance, like your friend has problem with delusions or has temptations, you know, towards, you know, false religions or something that are going to be exacerbated by this, then it's not a problem.
Eric, thank you very, very much, and thank you for sharing the good news about your walk into the Catholic Church. And call again sometime. We'd love to talk with you again. Sophie in San Antonio, Texas is next, listening on Guadalupe Radio. If I had been on my game today, I would have said anybody who calls from Guadalupe Radio goes to the top because it's Feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe. But Sophie, sorry we made you wait. Your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy and Sai. So I have a couple of questions. What is meditative and contemplative prayer? And my other question is, if a deacon or a priest is going to bless a religious item, does he need holy water, or can he bless it without the holy water?
So in regard to the first question, these terms are used differently by different authors, but in general, meditative prayer is where you are praying about something and you are contemplating or meditating on, I should say, some particular thing. Like, for example, in the rosary, when people say a decade of the rosary, they commonly meditate on a given mystery of the Christian faith, like the crucifixion or the nativity or the annunciation. And they think about that mystery. And they think about, when I do it, I think about what would it have been like to be right there when this happened. And they can think about, you know, what implications does this have for my life today? How can I live this mystery out today? What does this tell me about God? You know, various things. There are various things you can think about or meditate on while you're saying a prayer. And so that is kind of the core of what meditative prayer is. When people talk about contemplative prayer, if they're distinguishing the two, then generally contemplative prayer it's understood similarly, but also with an especial openness to allowing God to inspire you and give you some kind of inward grace that will help you be united to him in a special way that's often spoken of as a contemplative state. In terms of the second question, when a priest blesses an item, whether he needs holy water or not is going to depend on the nature of the blessing. And so this is something that's discussed in a book called The Book of Blessings. There are all kinds of different blessings in there. They have different instructions for different blessings. And consequently, I wouldn't stress about it. And in any event, God, whether a priest uses holy water or not, I would assume he knows what he's doing. And I wouldn't cross-examine him about it. And even if he made a mistake and used holy water when it didn't say to, or forgot to use holy water when it says to, God knows his intention and God knows your intention. And this is essentially prayer in enacted form. And God knows you're praying.
Sophie, thank you very, very much for the call. Appreciate it. It is open forum. Lines are pretty full at the moment, but you can still take a shot. 888-318-7884-888-31-TRUTH. Right now, the online sale continues at shop.catholic.com. You visit there. Everything's on sale. We've got hundreds of faith-filled gifts for everyone on your list. Savings up to 70% in some cases. Plus, we've got $5 flat rate shipping in the continental U.S. So visit us today at shop.catholic.com.
We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
The reason people should listen is so they can get excited about the faith and then share that faith with others. Because that's what it's about when we say, Jesus says, come follow me, but he also said, go and make disciples. We'll give you the tools needed for the new evangelization. Because that's the call to bring everyone into a relationship with Jesus Christ.
Open Line with Father Larry Richards, tonight, 10 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Tomorrow, I hope you will join us. It's one of our favorite days of the year. We have a lot of fun.
Friday?
Friday is one of our favorite days of the year.
Yeah.
Friday the 13th tomorrow.
Oh.
So I'm going to walk under a black cat.
Fortunately, I'm not superstitious, so.
No?
No.
That's good. I'm not either. I kind of enjoy doing anti-superstitious things on a Friday the 13th.
You're a contrarian.
I'm a contrarian. Yeah, I'm a superstition contrarian. But tomorrow, we're going to have the kids come in and ask questions. Any Catholic Answers kids that want to come in and ask a question can come in. So families and
I'm a kid
friends,
at heart. Does
neighbors.
That count?
Do you know how many people who call and say that during kids' shows? And we always say, no, it does not count.
Okay.
It's a kids' show. But we would love it if you would come by. There are going to be free cookies.
Yeah, sorry, fasting.
Oh, all right. But maybe I should have known that. Kelly in Missouri, you are up next. Your question for Jimmy Akin, please.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I am a new Catholic, finished RCIA this past Easter.
Congratulations.
And thank you. It's been long awaited. I'm very happy.
Yay.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. The most of my family is Protestant.
Mm-hmm.
And they keep coming at me with questions, and being new to all this, I'm trying to be armed.
Right.
They want to know, why do we pray to Mary at all?
Mm-hmm.
If we're just asking her to pray to Jesus, why don't we go straight to Jesus?
Well, we can and we should and we do. But that doesn't mean it doesn't also help to have other people praying alongside you as prayer partners. I would turn the question around on them and say, well, do you ever ask anyone else for their prayers? Why do you do that when you can just go directly to Jesus? And the answer is because God wants us to have prayer partners, because prayer, the whole purpose of prayer is not to give God information about what we want or what we need. God already knows all that. Jesus made this point, you know, that God knows what we need before we ask Him. So the purpose of prayer is not to give God information. The purpose of prayer is to draw us out of ourselves so that we think about God and so that we think about other people. And God has chosen to reward those behaviors, because the two things God cares about most are love of God and love of neighbor. Those are the two great commandments. And consequently, by thinking about God in prayer, we take a step towards loving God. And when we think about other people by praying for them, we're loving them. We're doing something loving for them. And so consequently, God wants us to pray to Him and for others to get us out of ourselves and have us exercise love. And that's why He wills to reward certain prayers when people are praying together. It's very clear. You read the New Testament and the Old Testament, but in particular the New Testament, and there are all these verses about praying for each other. Well, we're simply extending that principle to our fellow Christians who are in heaven. And so that's why. And if you need more information on that, we've got lots of stuff on Catholic.com about that and many other questions. Also, a particular book that I might recommend is one that I wrote called A Daily Defense. It has answers to 365 challenges to the Christian faith, and many of them are challenges that are made by our Protestant friends. And so when your Protestant relations come at you with a question and a challenge, this book would be a good resource to have to find an answer.
Marie, would you be willing to spend Radio Department money to send Kelly a copy of A Daily Defense? All right, Kelly, hang on the line.
I was hoping you'd say that.
Yeah, if you're welcome to say it anytime you want. You can spend Darren's money.
Okay.
We allow anybody that's here to spend Darren's money. Kelly, hang on. If you can give your address to Marie, she'll send A Daily Defense from Jimmy. Let's go to Sean in Bradford, Virginia, listening on the EWTN app. That's cool, Sean. Sean, your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, I was just curious if there are any saints that are not Catholic, and if not, is there anything in canon law that might be preventing that situation from happening?
So since all of the saints are in heaven, and everyone who's in heaven is fully united with Christ, that means that all of the saints are fully Catholic at this point. They all have the fullness of what Jesus wanted his followers to have because they're united with him in heaven. That's a separate question than were all of the saints in union with the Catholic Church when they were alive? And the answer to that is no.
Wait, what?
Yeah, there are. While the Catholic Church is not in the business of canonizing non-Catholics, because it holds the saints up as examples, you know, and to say, oh, this person knew about the Catholic Church, they were living in a society where they could have easily been Catholic, and they chose not to be. Well, that's not the kind of example you want to hold up when you canonize someone. But there are other circumstances. Sometimes you have a group of Christians who are not in union with the Catholic Church who later come in to the Catholic Church, who are reconciled with the Catholic Church.
Right.
And when that happens, it is traditional to go ahead and regard as a saint anybody that they had canonized. Because it's not really going to facilitate the cause of reconciliation if you say, oh, we want you to become Catholic, but you got to give up all these people that you've been honoring for centuries.
Yeah, right.
And so what happens is in the church's judgment, you know, God can give his grace even to people outside of the Catholic Church who weren't in full communion with it. And it may be presumed, you know, this person wasn't a heretic that left the Catholic Church themselves. They grew up in this other church. Everybody they knew was this other religion, and they still did a great job that, you know, acquired a reputation of holiness and orthodoxy for themselves in their own context, and that led them to be considered a saint by this group. And so we're going to honor that now that this group has come back into union with the Catholic Church. An example of that is actually a doctor of the church.
Really?
The most recent doctor of the church, Gregory of Narek.
Oh,
he was during his life a member of the Armenian Apostolic Church, which was not in union with the Catholic Church at the time. But he acquired a reputation for himself as a saint. He continued to be honored as a saint by the Armenians. In fact, he's like the big Armenian saint.
Okay.
And then a few hundred years ago, some Armenians reconciled with the Catholic Church and are now the Armenian Catholic Church. And so Gregory of Narek has been recognized as a saint subsequently in Catholic circles. John Paul II in Redemptor Hominis refers to him as Saint Gregory of Narek, for example. And earlier this year, Pope Francis, or at least very recently, Pope Francis declared him a doctor of the church.
Wow.
And interestingly, I happened to confirm all that earlier this afternoon before I came in. And this is an example that I have noticed where I seemingly quite more than I would expect from random chance will be thinking about something and take action on it to, you know, think about it and verify it very shortly before being
someone
asked
asks
about it on the air, even though there's no obvious connection. And I even keep a little file of those things to see maybe someday I can do the math and figure out, is it above chance or not? But how I would validate the null hypothesis in that case, I'm not sure.
But it's a beautiful thing to think about,
yeah.
that you're being, there seems to be some preparation going. It's not your
I'm very thankful for it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. Sean, thanks very much for the question. I'm going to keep moving and try to get as many as I can in. Susanna in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, watching on YouTube Live. You are next. Susanna, your question for Jimmy.
Okay, I'll be quick. I have a different number of Bibles,
mm-hmm.
and my question is about the Old Testament, because different versions have different chapters mm-hmm. of the same passages, let's say Esther, Joel, and the Psalms. How that came about?
In different ways. Basically, the chapter divisions are something that aren't in the original manuscripts, except for the Psalms. And so there have been different systems of chapters proposed down through the ages. And even though since the 1200s, there's been one commonly used set of chapter divisions, it's not universal, and there have been some variations. One of the variations concerns the book of Psalms, because even though there were chapter divisions in the original, because each psalm is its own chapter, it's its own song, there was confusion at times about, well, is this really one psalm or is it two?
Oh, yeah.
And because people weren't always sure whether this block of text represented one psalm or two psalms, we knew there's supposed to be 150 of them, but there would be little differences in the numbering based on how you grouped the text. And so that's why some psalms have different numbers. I'm not aware of Joel having different chapter numbers. But you will find some books. She mentioned Esther.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons for Esther is because Esther is a biblical book that had two editions. It had one edition that is, you can call it the proto-canonical edition. It was probably the first one written. And one of the things about it is it doesn't mention God anywhere in the text. And so God later inspired a second edition, and he did this with more than one book in the Bible. There are multiple books have had more than one edition. Jeremiah is an example of that. God inspired Jeremiah to start a first edition, and then a king burned it up. And so God inspired Jeremiah to write a second expanded edition. Well, he did something similar with Esther, and had new sections added to it that do make God's role in the story explicit. And there's then a question of how do you integrate these additional sections, and that affects the chapter numbering. So that's why Esther has some chapter differences. You'll also find differences on the verse level. And again, this is just because the verse divisions are not in the original text. They're come up with by later people, and different groups of people have had different verse numbering systems.
You could probably benefit a great deal from Jimmy's new book, The Bible is a Catholic Book. So I will recommend that to you. And you can get it as an ebook or an audiobook,
paperback.
I was just thinking about mailing to Canada if she wanted to avoid mailing to Canada. I would suggest it, Susanna. I'm going to keep going. I want to get one more question if I can. Mark in Sioux Falls, North Dakota, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio, Channel 130. Your question, real quick, for Jimmy. No? Mark?
Hello?
Oh, hello. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, it's South Dakota. Anyway, the Catholic Church's dirty little secret is regard, that's what it's called anyway in my circles, about tuba ligation and, whatever we do to men.
Vasectomy is probably what you're thinking.
Done and vasectomies in Catholic hospitals, and that's going on. Is there anything we can do about it?
Okay.
If you become aware of it, talk to the bishop. The bishop is the one who is typically involved in granting or revoking the status of a hospital to be able to call itself Catholic. And if you are aware of an institution like a hospital that is flagrantly acting contrary to Catholic morals, then talk to the local bishop. Now, in some cases, the bishop is able to do something about it. In other cases, the bishop may not. There have been some hospitals that have said, we don't care what the bishop is going to say. We're a separate legal entity. And even if he says we can no longer call ourselves St. Teresa's Catholic Hospital, we're going to still call ourselves St. Teresa's Hospital.
Yeah, sure.
And right. and continue to convey the impression that we're Catholic, even if he's not allowing us to officially call ourselves Catholic.
And the bishops have directives on this. What's the name of the U.S. Catholic bishops have healthcare directives?
Yeah,
yeah. And so the hospitals, if they're going to maintain a Catholic identity, are supposed to follow those directives. But as Jimmy said, the way the real world works is often otherwise. Jimmy's book is the Bible is a Catholic book. Oh, by the way, Mark, thank you very much for the call. You can get the Bible is a Catholic book in all of its different forms. If you want to hear the audio version, go to audible.com for the ebook, the soft cover book. Or bulk packaging, just go to shop.catholic.com. It's especially good time for bulk editions. Maybe you can share them with other members of your parish or your Bible study group as Christmas approaches. Jimmy Akin, thank you very much.
Thank you, Cy Kellett.
And don't forget, I'm not saying this to you because I know you're not going to forget. Tomorrow okay. is Friday. That means Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World new edition is out, and it will be on alien-related deaths in Brazil.
Yes.
All right. And join us here, I hope you will, for a fun kind of party atmosphere when the Catholic Answers kids come in to ask the questions on the show. We'll see you then, God willing.